You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
And that was Ghost Town, and I'm Sam Stone. You're listening to the Stone Tapes, and here in the studio today we have the lovely Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
David J. Howe.
Hello.
And our new resident, George Mann.
Hello. I'm squatting.
You live in here now.
Well, I must tell you, George, last time we recorded, Patricia said afterwards, she said, George is lovely, can we keep him? And I went, yes.
Thank you very much.
So living in Sam's pocket.
Yeah, we've never let him go since.
So. Yeah, trapped in the studio.
Anyway, this afternoon, this evening, or whatever time of day it is that you're listening, because you could be listening anywhere in the world to the Stone Tapes, George is going to now talk to us about crime writing. George, the man factor this week. Tell us about crime writing.
The man factor.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good thing to talk about, because largely this month I've been reading and writing a lot of crime fiction. And really kind of trying to investigate, if you see what I did there.
Yes.
the genre in a bit more depth, because I've always been a fan of crime fiction in its many forms, but mostly, I suppose, through television. So things like Lewis and Morse and Midsummer Murders are my kind of comfort go-to TV. They're the things when I just want to chill out. It's something like that that I put on, and I think as a tribute to kind of that comfort, so that cozy crime feeling, I wanted to write a crime novel. But in doing so, I kind of thought, well, I'm going to delve a bit deeper into the conventions of the genre, the written genre, because obviously you've spent a lot of time writing and reading science fiction fantasy.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel I know how a science fiction fantasy story is constructed, but a crime novel is obviously a whole different kettle of fish. So I thought I'll dive in and do a lot of reading to start with. And one of the first things I discovered was that it really helps if your first name's Peter.
Peter,
because the books I've been reading have been Peter by Peter Lovesey, Peter May, Peter James, and Peter Robinson.
Right. Isn't that interesting? I haven't made that observation.
The new novel will be from Peter Mann. No, not really.
Well, it's guaranteed to be a bestseller
Exactly. But it's been really fascinating to read these books, and they're all UK based crime. They're all set around. They all kind of take a different location and really go into depth with it. The ones I've really fallen in love with have been the Peter Robinson books, where he's created a town called Eastvale in North Yorkshire, Northumberland. And it's kind of a bit like my old stomping ground from when I was growing up, so it's kind of familiar countryside. But absolutely marvellous stories. He creates such a great sense of place and such a great sense of character.
And sort of down to earth as well, if it's sort of Yorkshire for us. I mean, that it's somehow it does seem to lend itself to crime. When you said it, I thought, what an obvious and amazing place, but perfect.
It is. It's got kind of this town at the centre of it with this kind of traditional Yorkshire life. And then you've got all these rural locations where they can go and visit and find bodies. In one of the early novels, they find a body that's been half built into a dry stone wall.
Oh, good grief.
Up on the hills. And
that's like harking back to Lovecraft, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
It's kind of a bit like that. And the one I've just been reading they're kind of started in the 80s, this series, and they're still going. He's 20 odd books now with the same detective. Wow. But he changes over time with the years passing. So the first ones are set in the late 80s. And it's a fascinating look back at the time as well. The novel I've just been reading is about kind of a gay couple and one of the women's been killed, and the attitudes at the time to the kind of the homosexual relationship is really quite shocking, actually, even from the policeman. So it's kind of a great insight into kind of the era. But what's been really interesting is kind of reading that stuff and then going away and writing. And I know, Sam, you've been writing crime novel as well, haven't you? So it's kind of an interesting comparison for both of us to do something a bit different and go and kind of work out how these novels work.
And what was your observation of what would be the... Well, if anybody who's listening to this and wants to write crime, what would you say would be something you necessarily need to write a crime novel?
Wow. You need to understand how, but at least by the end of writing the book, you need to have understood how the killer has done what they've done, and you need to have put the clues in place so that the reader could have worked it out. You kind of don't want them to work it out, but at the same time, they need to be able to look back and go, oh, of course, that's what that meant. Because if you haven't done that, then you effectively jump the shark at the end by going, and the killer is, ta-da, and they go,
absolutely,
what?
Yeah.
This person's had no screen time or, you know, in the book. Or...
I agree with you. I'll ask you about that because you've just written one yourself. Did you know yourself before you wrote the ending who was going to be the killer?
I did. And
was that planned from the very beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I went into writing this book with the same sort of attitude as I've written on my other books, which is the planet first.
Yes.
So I kind of worked out the crimes, who died when in the book and how, and who the killer was, and the cast of characters, and I kind of built a chapter plan, but really, really went off piece this time compared to what I usually do, because in a sense I felt like I was in the detective's chair investigating the story and the characters. I think trying to get setting a book in a modern era and trying to get into the characters' heads a bit more than I would necessarily do in a kind of adventure novel, they started to behave in ways that I wasn't expecting, and you know, little clues would pop
Interesting.
Up, and then I'd think I'd end up rewriting my chapter plan a few chapters ahead, you know, because I'm going, oh, this has happened, and this person's died, and this character's taken on a prominence in the story that I wasn't expecting, and in fact, actually, one of the characters became an accomplice of the killer, and that really wasn't something I'd planned.
Wow, that's great.
So, and actually, the other aspect of it was the killer really developed a motivation that hadn't been there when I first planned it as well. A real kind of, I'm hoping that the readers will see it, have a sense of kind of a weird sense of empathy or sympathy with the killer by the end, and they realise why he's doing what he's done. It's horrendous, but you can understand.
But you put his
background,
logic,
the background that he's come from, and has shaped him. So you kind of feel sorry for him at the same time. So yeah, it's been a really fascinating experience.
Yes, that's quite a journey, really, because what's happened to you there is you've developed in a different way. I mean, I'm one of these, I do plan sometimes, but I'm mostly a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants type of writer.
Right.
And I actually enjoy that more because it's more of an exploration of where things can go when I'm not expecting them. And I did plan the one I was writing, and I even knew who the killer was, but I changed my mind completely halfway through and threw the whole synopsis away. And went with it and still didn't decide till maybe the last chapter which was the killer. But I had set up several people that it could be.
Yeah.
So I'd obviously, again, with the crime thing, because it's very important to sow seeds, isn't it?
Very much so.
So I'd sowed the seeds that it could be any one of these people so that it wouldn't be sort of so unexpected or out of the blue or random or unbelievable. Because at the end of the day, your readers have got to believe what you've done. So I think it is a fascinating journey, especially in crime. And I love to do twists and turns. But for now, we're going to listen to a bit of Weird Crimes.
Your incoherence, fire blonde boy.
And George, I was just thinking, listening to you talk about writing crime in general, and obviously this writing a book that you wanted to write, a story you wanted to tell. How different is that from doing the Sherlock Holmes tie-ins, or any tie-in for that example?
Very different, actually, for me. I mean, there's an element of plotting that's with a Sherlock Holmes novel that's going to be similar to writing another crime novel, I think, in that you have to lay that trail of clues. But for me, working in a tie-in universe, or you know, trying to write with someone else's character, is about picking up their voice, be it written or be it like with Doctor Who, where you're listening to the speech patterns of the character, and you've got to try and get into that character's head and write from that character's perspective, and that's the element of tie-in. So with the Sherlock books, obviously, you're generally talking from Watson's perspective, so you've got to be Watson for the story, and that can be restricting, not necessarily in a bad way, because it can make you be lean and think carefully about every word, but at the same time, you can't jump around. You can't say, well, I'm going to go to this character's perspective now. You know, it all has to be from
randomly
Watson.
He has just to wander off.
He has to see everything, exactly.
I was going to say as well that for a Sherlock Holmes tale as well, I get the impression that there would be a particular way that story would need to be resolved. Holmes is quite unique in the way he does that.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's like when you see an Agatha Christie story, it's gather everyone in the dining room or in front of the fire.
And there's always so many weapons it could be. Yeah, who done it?
And with Holmes, it, I think it needs to unfold in a particular way as well, exactly, where he gives his clear deductions and says, this is how it all happened, isn't it? Because I knew from the start.
That's right.
Yes, yeah. Remember when you first came in the room, when we first met him?
Exactly. But with this one, it's been really interesting because for the first time ever properly, I've written a whole novel from a woman's point of view.
You've not written from a woman's point of view before?
I've had Veronica sections in the New Ruin Hobbs books, but never kind of gone, and especially a modern woman as well, you know, with all the preoccupations of kind of being a modern person that I don't have in the New Ruin Hobbs books. That was really interesting.
Harder for you than writing in another sort of time zone or era?
Yeah, it was actually.
Write sort of right now, here and
until
now.
Until I got into the groove. I hit the groove with it, and when started having them using their mobile phones and apps and referencing music and stuff. And there was actually a thing that the author Joanne Harris put out on Twitter recently about writing women. She said, if anyone's writing a woman, just write it as a man and change it to...
Exactly.
From he to
yeah.
She.
Exactly.
And I thought, oh God, of course. That's
exactly.
That really helped me a lot.
Because we do just think the same in the end, really.
Right.
I think, especially the modern.
A whole lot of difference.
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say, is it any different from you, Sam, writing a man?
Absolutely not.
Exact question I was going to ask. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think it's. I mean, I start my very first character was a man, my Gabrielle from my first novel. So I went straight into that, but it was easier because I did it in first person as well, so you kind of fall into the voice,
right, yeah,
which is kind of easier. I prefer to write third person a lot more now, and so I think that can be a little bit harder, but then in some ways I'm often head hopping anyway in that situation, so I'm sort of often in different heads, male or female. And I do think, like, the great advice, you know, men and women these days, there isn't a whole lot of difference in our way of thinking, especially in the modern.
Right.
It's different if you were writing a Victorian woman and her perception of...
I think the main difference, actually, would be just education.
Yes.
Now men and women are educated pretty much the same.
That's right.
Back then, there were very big differences.
That's a really good point.
What he would know, what they would think about each other...
It's interesting, actually, just going back to the Peter Robinson books in the 80s, and the way that women are treated in those earlier books is different as well. It's, you know, it's a bit like, again, it's true of the early Morse novels, is that the women are all quite sexualized. They all kind of, they want to sleep with the detective or flirt with the detective. Exactly. And, you know, in this one, there's a group of Amdram actors, and there's one particular woman who's portrayed very much like, you know, tries to sleep with him, and he's like, "Hang on, you're a suspect." and all everyone else in the Amdram side, he's like, "Oh, she does that with every bloke at least once." hang on a minute, this isn't a particularly good, you know.
But then, of course, it's wonderful because that is right for the era,
yeah,
and that was current.
True.
And so as much, but it's interesting that we find all that cringeworthy now, because it shows how much we've evolved in 20 or 30 years. A big difference. I was also thinking that Life on Mars did that very well as well.
Oh, brilliant.
Because they reflected
it?
Very much about what the 80s was like as well.
Well,
70s. 70s,
actually, and then the
80s.
Yeah. It still felt like the 80s to me, though, somehow, with the first one. Maybe I was tripping, I don't know.
But yeah, that whole kind of Sweeney approach to policing.
Yeah,
stuff,
it was,
yeah.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Do you see that, Life on Mars, Patricia?
No.
Oh, we're going to have to indoctrinate you to that one as well.
Yes, please. Please educate me.
Oh. So, as a typical...
between a boy and man. She was 17 and she was far from in between. It was summertime in northern Michigan. Splashing through the sandbar, talking by the campfire. It's the simple things in life, like when and where. Shined upon her head. And we were trying different things, and we were smoking funny things, making love out by the lake to our favorite song, sipping whiskey out the bottle, not thinking about tomorrow, singing Sweet Home Alabama all summer long. Sweet Home Alabama all summer long. Singing Sweet Home Alabama.
as it's a typical English summer at the moment, cold and raining. That was All Summer Long by Kid Rock. And now we're going to go rapidly over to Patricia's Corner. Patricia, editor of Gearheart Steampunk Glamour Review magazine, what have you been looking at this week?
Well, I've been a bit ill, so I've been watching television instead of reading books. And I've just watched a new series from the BBC called The Living and the Dead, which is about live people and also dead people.
Ah.
There's ghosts in this series. Right. So there's a lot of horror elements, and the episodes don't always end on a happy note. Sometimes people die. Wright should probably tell you what it's about. So there's a psychiatrist. His name is Nathan Appleby, and he moves back home to his childhood home, which is a farm in Somerset. It's gorgeous in Somerset. Absolutely visit it. Yeah, except maybe not this particular town. There's ghosts. So he's a man of science, and then he starts seeing ghosts. There's some ghosts possessing people. There's ghosts that lure children to their doom. There's ghosts that appear to their murderers and scare them. And there's just ghosts of all sorts of things. And it's not just him that starts seeing these things. I mean, at first it is, and everyone's like, wow, he's kind of lost it. But then other people start seeing the ghosts as well. And it's looking more and more like the town is just cursed. That's what all the villagers think. They're like, well, it's just cursed here. It is 1894, and it's awfully... it's just at that cusp of a major revolution in agriculture and just, like, kind of the dying off of all the folk stories and folk beliefs. So that's kind of crashing together. And then there's ghosts. The thing that really separates
it... Does it have ghosts?
A few of them.
Okay.
A few of them. It's not like some series where you're like, oh, that could have been a ghost, but it also could have been this. No, it's ghosts. It's definitely ghosts.
So they're not sort of like supernatural sort of becoming demons, but you said that some of them are being possessing people.
Yes. There's a lot of angry ghosts in this series, which is very interesting. So it's very much sort of a horror thing. If possessions scare you, don't watch this one.
So the premise is this doctor guy has basically got to sort of work out what's going on. Is that the basic
premise?
Yeah,
he's got to work out what's going on, why he's seeing all these ghosts. Right. And he's not just seeing ghosts from the past. He's also seeing ghosts from the future.
Wow.
There's this woman in a red parka who's got a book of light, which is an iPad.
Interesting.
That keeps showing up in his house and on his farm. So he's trying to figure out what she's doing there. And he's got all kinds of residual guilt because his child from his first marriage drowned, and he's a ghost, inevitably. Because everybody who's ever died and whoever will die in this little town in Somerset is coming back and going, hello!
Wow, how interesting. Oh, an interesting premise.
Gosh, yeah.
So is every episode a kind of different case with a different ghost, or is it more of an ongoing?
The first couple of them are very much like that. The last couple of episodes are more of an arc story, an overarching story, and there's also an overarching story. You should watch this whole thing instead of, like, jumping in the middle. It will make a lot more sense that way. Fortunately, it's all on the BBC iPlayer app.
Oh, that's
that I
good.
Might have on my iPad, on my Book of Light.
Other tablets are available.
Yes. But my Book of Light's an iPad.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is binge watchable, which may be
I think we're going to have to check that one out.
You'd really enjoy it. It's starring Colin Morgan, who, if you saw the show Merlin, he's kind of the title character in that.
Right,
so you'll go, oh, yeah, that guy looks really familiar. Except he's got more hair and a beard in this one. And I think, David, you're really going to like the music in this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of really, really eerie stuff.
Oh, I love that.
So you'll love this. And
sounds like
some modern music done sort of as folk tunes and some folk tunes done kind of more modern. Mm. And really creepy songs.
We will have to dig some of these
brilliant.
Out for the stone types
look.
Going forward. So, yeah, what sort of mark would you give that then?
I'd give it definitely an 8 out of 10.
Wow.
I will watch the second series when it comes out. Because
have they said they're going to do a second season? Because you know what things are like.
Yeah.
You just get through one season, then they
set
it
up.
They have set it up where there could be a second season. So once everything is solved and the ghosts have been laid to rest, you're like, oh, everything's great. They're going to live happily ever. Nope.
Ah.
Nope, nope, nope. He's seeing some more ghosts now from
Excellent.
The future.
Okay, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Reminds me a bit of a series that David and I have been watching recently called Outcast.
A little bit. There's a lot of possession stuff on at the moment.
Ooh, that's possession.
It makes me think a bit about The Returned as well, the French series
that we saw,
which was a town full of ghosts and stuff. So,
I liked the first season of that, but I couldn't get into the second one of that. But Outcast is new. We've just seen the first season, and they have just put up the a preview of this first episode of the second season.
Okay.
So it's definitely going to continue that, which I was pleased about, because I hate it when they did that with Dracula,
yes,
the Rhys Meyers one. I was really upset that they only did one season of that.
Aww.
It seems to be a lot of series at the moment. It's just getting axed. So...
Are you interested in video games? If so, be sure to join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den, your weekly dose of tech and games. Treat yourself to the latest news, interviews, some brilliant music, and much more. After all, it is approved by...
me, Duke Nukem.
Kane from Command and Conquer.
Agent 47.
Colonel Roy Campbell.
And more. So join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den. Every Wednesday, 10 till 12.
On Siren FM 107.3.
Ghost in My House, R. Dean Taylor. And George, you just came up with a really interesting fact about Outcast.
Yeah, just mention that it's based on a comic book series that's currently running. I think there's been 18 issues, and it's by Robert Kirkman, who's the same guy who created The Walking Dead.
Wow, interesting.
Which is one of the reasons I think it just obviously made it straight from comic book to TV because of his pedigree.
Yeah. And it's so good, and I can see it now continuing probably because of his name.
Yeah.
And on the phone at the moment, we've got Hello Stranger, Joshua Lou Friedman from Los Angeles. Hi. Uh-oh.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you, yes.
Hi. Hi, Josh.
Can you hear me okay?
We can, yes.
Hi,
good to have you back.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, tell us tell us some gossip from Los Angeles at the moment. What's going on over there?
Oh God, well, we just wrapped a pretty big, it's a big horror film, but it's a period piece and a horror film at the same time. This is a very good one coming out with some of the stars of upcoming Twin Peaks. And if you ever saw the movie Ravenous, the cannibal film, it was kind of a period piece of a horror film. It's very similar to that.
No,
and
I haven't seen that one.
Takes
but...
place during the... Oh, God, put it on your list. I can't believe you haven't seen
Ravenous.
It.
Write that one down, David.
yeah, but it's an action horror film, First Nations, you know, the War of 1812, Americans are still, you know, it's like The Revenant, which we shot. It's like basically The Revenant, but an action horror chase movie.
Oh, right.
But with around the same setting. So, yeah, the whole movie is one big giant chase with the Americans chasing the First Nations through the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And the bad guys were taken out one by one, and it's very, very gruesome and very gory, and yet period specific with amazing use of upstate New York location. So, great stuff.
What's it called, Josh?
Oh, I didn't say the name of it.
No, I'm sorry, what was that again?
Mohawk.
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 Mohawk. Mohawk. Mohawk. Oh, Mohawk. Like Indian hair. Right, Mohawk. Okay.
Yes, Mohawk. There you go. Mohawk. Action horror film. Totally amazing. Great effects. It's going to be coming out next year. Lots of fun. Well, hopefully toward the end of this year, we'll see. See how quickly they can get it all chopped together.
So have you seen Ghostbusters yet, Josh?
I have not seen Ghostbusters yet. I did go we went down because I live near the Chinese Theater in Hollywood. So my wife and I walked down and checked out the premiere, which was pretty cool. They had a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man all blown up in front of the Chinese Theater. They had a mock-up of the Ghostbusters, the original building was there in front.
Wow.
And the car was there. And
oh, nice, fantastic.
Slime green carpet for the stars to walk on.
That's fantastic.
Oh. Yeah. So, but I'm hearing all the buzz is good, though. People are, quiet as the haters, and reviews are generally positive on tour. So I'm actually very excited to see it.
And do you know anyone that's in that one, Josh? Do you know any of the gang that
I
are in
I don't
that?
Know anyone that's in there. You know what? I can't say that. I actually know a lot of the crew. Because I just shot two films back-to-back in Cape Cod last year, and all the crew just got off of Ghostbusters.
Oh, that's Ghostbusters very cool.
Was shot in Boston.
Oh, wow.
I know all the behind-the-scenes people, and boy, do they have some fun stuff to show me on their phones. So I'm really excited about this one, actually. I'm not one of the haters, and I was always felt good about this, and I apparently the reviews are in, and most of the people generally agree. So very excited to see it this weekend.
So what recent film would you recommend, Josh?
What's just come out in Hollywood that you think's good?
Oh, what that I think is good. You know, usually they're like smaller independent films, but I think it's now available out on Blu-ray. I think you can get it everywhere internationally. It's a smaller film with the late Anton Yelchin, you know, who died recently.
Yes.
It's a thriller called The Green Room. He's the head of a punk band who is, they're hurting for money, and they go out to play a gig, and the gig is out in the middle of nowhere, and it turns out the gig is for a group of white supremacists out in the out there in the boonies, and they witness a murder, and the white supremacists aren't going to let them leave, and the white supremacists are led by Patrick Stewart.
Oh my gosh.
Great turn.
Yeah.
And it's a very suspenseful movie. So this poor band, they're stuck in there, they've got to fight their way out. And Patrick Stewart is like kind of the big cat and mouse game between Anton Yelchin and Patrick Stewart throughout the whole film. Very suspenseful, a very tight, very solid film. I recommend it wholeheartedly.
I think that's one we're going to have to look into. Such a shame about Yeltsin as well. So sad. Must have shocked everyone there.
Yes, on the new Star Trek film and everything. Yeah, it was a big shock. I mean, I don't know what that means, for the franchise. I know they're being very respectful about it in the advertising of the film and what have you. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm actually going to see Star Trek on the Paramount lot the following weekend. I'm very excited about that.
Oh, brilliant. You'll have to report on that next time. Yeah,
you have to report.
I will. I'll be your man on Paramount and your man in Havana. Did you guys already talk about The Fog?
No, we want you to stay with us to talk about The Fog. We want you to stay. So,
yes.
Here we go. We've got the main theme tune, and then we'll come back to you, Josh.
As Josh quite rightly said, we're going to talk about The Fog today. So we're going to go over to David's film of the month.
Yes, yes, yes. So my film of the month this month is a 1980 film called The Fog. Nothing whatsoever to do with James Herbert's novel of the same name. I think a lot of people got confused about that. Directed by a young chap called John Carpenter. And it was the first film that John Carpenter did after his success with Halloween, which was, of course, the archetypal slasher movie. It's a great film. It stars Adrienne Barbeau, Jamie Lee Curtis. It's got Tom Atkins, Janet Leigh, and Hal Holbrook in. In terms of what's it all about, then, it's pretty straightforward, to be honest. It's about a little town in America that is celebrating its 100th birthday. But that 100th birthday was built on some gold that was stolen from a group of sailors. And so on the 100th birthday, the sailors all come back in a strange fog to effectively wreak their revenge on six people in the town. Six must die, as the film says. And it really is as simple as that. It's a great little film, as I say. Adrienne Barbeau plays a sort of a late-night disc jockey, radio host kind of person. And as Sam and I noted when we watched the film last night, it's really interesting that she only actually appears with one other character in the film, which is her son, little boy who plays her son. Absolutely fascinating, because none of the other characters even meet her. They all talk to her or listen to her on the phone, but they don't actually meet her. Jamie Lee Curtis plays a hitchhiker, gets picked up by Tom Atkins, who plays a character called Nick Castle. And that brings me to another neat little thing about the film, is that it's full of these little in-jokes. Nick Castle was the name of the actor who played the killer in Halloween. It's kind of surreal. Yeah. We've got Charles Cyphers plays a character called Dan O'Bannon, who is in fact a writer who wrote Alien and another film called Dead and Buried.
And Dark Star.
Dark Star, yeah, thanks, Josh.
And Dark Star for John Carpenter,
yeah. Much more beside. There's another character in it called Dr. Fibes, which always amuses
me. We all know
me.
That one.
I think you should know who Dr. Fibes is. As I say, it's a tremendous film. I'm interested to see, I pulled some stuff off Wiki as usual. I can see here that apparently Carpenter said that the film was actually inspired partly by a British film called The Trollenberg Terror, which we watched just
we did
the
watch
other week.
Crawling
we did.
The Crawling Eye, that's right, in America.
I was dragged kicking and screaming to the TV and forced to watch it.
And it was good, wasn't it?
Because it's black and white.
Yes, which is a tremendous, and that's about monsters that hide in clouds and things.
It was actually good, it was.
And
it
there's lots of stuff like that going on with it. It seemed to have done fairly well as well. Again, a few little notes and stuff I've got here. I can see that the film apparently cost something like $1.1 million to make, which was, I suppose, not bad for a film in 1980. But it made $21.3 million.
That's a good return on
it. It's a pretty good return on a million-dollar film, isn't it? It's a lovely film. It's a wonderful film. Sam, you had a few thoughts on it as we were watching it about just how sort of scary it is, really.
Yeah, very intense. I think psychologically, Carpenter does something with this film that it's actually really, really hard to do. And he builds up the suspense like a writer would when they're writing a book in this very slow, almost slow delivery.
Yeah,
but it builds and builds and builds, and I said it is actually something you could do easily in writing a novel, but not necessarily when showing it as a film. But it does it brilliantly.
I mean, one of the things that I noted was the kind of there's a sense of dread which kind of slowly builds throughout the film. It's really aided by the soundtrack as well. We heard the music there, which is written by John Carpenter, as he tended to do for most of his films. But the music, particularly when the fog comes in, there's a very low hum on the soundtrack that just sort of grows and moves as the fog kind of moves through the film. Mm. And how they got the to do that, I have no idea, Josh. Yeah, go on.
Josh, thoughts?
Well, no, I was going to say, I think what adds to the building tension of the film as well, the sense of dread that it installs early on, are the scenes where, like, the town is just coming apart by itself before the actual fog sets in, where, you know, like, car alarms and car lights start going off and phones start ringing.
That's
and
right.
Gas pumps start blowing. all of that adds to this unsettling ease that culminates to when Reflog actually appears.
And it is a very...
really well, masterfully crafted.
It's a very frightening film as well. Patricia, how did you feel about it?
I really liked it. I thought it was eerie, and that's apparently my favorite word today, eerie. But I really liked it. I liked the radio lady who kind of pulled it all together, because as everybody's driving around trying to figure out what the heck is going on, they're listening to her on the radio.
And she's kind of figured it out already, hasn't she, by then?
A little bit.
What's happening, sort of.
Yeah. And there's the beautiful scenes, I think, particularly in the church, when they open doors and there's fog there, and then this figure just sort of emerges, or just standing there silently. And it is so creepy.
And you never really see the figures very clearly.
And that's, I think,
it's
quite
mostly
deliberate.
A hand coming out and grabbing people.
And it's quite brutal. It's quite brutal as
stabbing,
well, the deaths and everything. And I love the sequence where Adrienne Barbeau is on top of the lighthouse being chased up there by two or three or four of these ghosts that are kind of just going for her.
Yeah,
and
her
fingers are kind of screeching on the metal. Oh, it's tremendous, tremendous. George, I know you've not had a chance to see it recently, but you saw it
a long time ago. I just remember being terrified, really. I mean, I think I probably watched it I was about 18, 19. And, for years afterwards, I didn't want to walk home in the fog. We used to get quite a lot of fog where I lived in the northeast, and I'd go out to the pub and I'd be walking home late at night, a couple of miles across Darlington. Whenever there was mist or fog, I was looking for the figures coming looming out of it.
Yeah, well, as long as it's not glowing, you're okay.
Yeah, that's true, that's true. I mean, Josh, did you work with Adrienne Barbeau? Have I got that completely wrong?
Recently, yeah. I wasn't there the day we brought her in, but we did a movie last year called Tales of Halloween. And I think I've talked about it on the show before.
Yes.
It's available now everywhere. And, I did half the stories, because it's like, you know, all these different 10 different directors, 10 different short stories that take place on Halloween night. Now, the wraparound story, there's always in an anthology something that links all the stories. They all take place in the same town, and they all have the radio going. So we brought Adrienne Barbeau to be the radio DJ.
Who else?
Who opens the film.
Really awesome.
And links all the stories. And we're not saying it's the same character from the fog, but... yeah, it's Stevie Wayne
from
the
fog. Yeah, Stevie Wayne. Oh, dear.
We just brought her in and said, do it. We're huge fans. And when you see the film, she is the linking narrative. And you actually see her on camera at the beginning. She kicks off our movie.
So just
Stevie Wayne.
Just to close off on the fog, then, I think we give it some marks out of 10. I think it's got to be something like a 9 out of 10 for me. I mean, it's such a tremendous piece of storytelling. For 1980, very scary, very different from Halloween, a very kind of different take on ghosts.
I preferred it. I'm not a big fan of Halloween, but I think it's a 9.5 for me, and I'll tell you for why, because I think not only was it very scary and beautifully done, but I think it stood the test of time really well, because it's years and years since I've seen that film, and I didn't feel like it was dated, which is an interesting thing, I think.
Yeah.
That is an excellent point. Yeah.
Patricia,
it wasn't dated, was it?
No.
I feel like, oh, this is a dead old-fashioned scary movie.
Yeah. But it's a very modern sort of scary movie, even though they're wearing things that are...
Yes.
Yeah, even the clothing was different. It didn't feel old.
But I think, again, that the makeup on the figures that you don't quite see, and the glowing eyes and the cross that glows, all done by Rob Bottin, who's one of my favourite makeup artists, of course.
Yeah. He played Blake too. At the
he
end
played
of
Blake, the guy. But he did The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing. He did The Howling, great werewolf movie. He's done some tremendous practical effects.
Love
was what
the
Rob
Howling.
Bottin was good at. So, Josh, I think we're gonna.
What do you think, Josh? Marks out of 10.
Oh yeah, I give it a solid 10. And I got to say, real quick, Andy, we were talking about archetypes and sharing scenes together earlier. You know, how great is it to have, like, Jamie Lee Curtis, who was, you know, fresh off of the modern Scream Queen, doing a scene, not until toward the end of the film, they don't share a scene together, but doing a scene with her mother, Janet Leigh.
I thought that as well. I did comment on it. Yes,
and
I thought
the shower
so.
Scene from Psycho, you know?
I know, it's just tremendous. Just tremendous.
To
so
together in a scene for our fans.
And what about you, Patricia? Marks, did you give
your
marks?
I would say 8 out of 10.
Okay. 8 out of 10? And... off the top of your head with the memory?
I'd probably go with at least an 8 out of 10 as well. Yeah, very much so.
Fantastic. Josh, before we end the Stone Tapes...
You can't say the same about the remake.
Oh, yes, well, the remake.
We won't mention that.
We're not even going to give that an airing. It was that good.
Yeah, we won't, don't mention the remake.
We won't go into the remake as well.
Before
we go, Josh, I think it would be really lovely if we ended the Stone Tapes today with one of your amazing cocktails.
I created one for today's episode.
Ooh,
and you know, in honor of the fog.
Ooh.
I threw together something called Blake Gold.
Blake Gold, I like it.
Blake's Gold.
Yeah.
And all you do is you take a Malibu rum with a dash of sweet and sour, and you add blue curacao for the nice blue ocean look to it, and then a dash of Goldschlager, which is cinnamon liqueur that has shavings of gold in it.
Ooh.
And then you have your fog drink, which I will call Blake's Gold. And it's pretty good.
Well, I think I'm going to have to try that next time I see you. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, so Malibu rum, blue curacao, sweet and sour, and Goldschlager. And you have Blake's Gold.
Fantastic. And I think that's all we've got time for today. Thanks so much to David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, George Mann, of course, you, Josh, and we're very glad to have had you back, and our amazing producer, Alex Levchuk.
You're back.
Till next time.
Yes, great. Till then.
Of the opera.